Hello, heroes, and welcome to Backstory. I'm your host, Alex Roberts. Heroes, I will be at Dreamation in Morristown, New Jersey this weekend, so if you're there, come and say hello. I'm going to be LARPing and hanging out, and hopefully playtesting Tension a couple times. I don't know if I've talked much about Tension here on the show. It's my work-in-progress two-player game that uses a Jenga tower to represent unresolved romantic and sexual attraction. It's coming along. I hope to have more to say about it after this weekend. Our guest today is Maury Brown, president of Learn LARP, an educational consulting and game design company focused on the power of role-playing games as co-created participatory experiences that build empathy, collaboration, problem-solving, critical thinking, and awareness. That's the company behind New World Magiscola, aka Real Life Wizard School, aka the magical world where I learned to believe in myself. Maury has lots more in the works for Magiscola and for Learn LARP in general, so let's jump right in. I've just realized that what I would really like to do is have the Who We Are section of the Learn LARP website open as I chat with you.
Okay.
Because I'm looking at your mission and at your vision and the way that you articulate your values. My new thing on the show is asking people, how do your games fight fascism? As it becomes increasingly relevant.
Yes.
Yeah, so, you know what, why don't I just hit you with that one first? Is that something you've been consciously doing from the start with Learn LARP? Because you certainly seem to be doing it, in my opinion.
Absolutely. That is actually sort of the underpinning values of Learn LARP is using storytelling as a way to help people get in touch with themselves and get in touch with each other. Storytelling allows us to put ourselves in the shoes or to take on the perspective of someone else. And I've been a literature professor for many years and seen the power of story through literature and cultural studies, films, movies, books, poetry, teaching students from fifth grade through graduate school. And then LARP takes all of that one step further because it doesn't just have you imagine or watch the story of someone else or the perspective of someone else, but you embody that and you interact with others. And in a LARP that is designed where you have the power and of choice and consequence, where you can take the decisions and watch the story unfold in front of you, you get the chance to really both imaginatively and in body form experience something outside of your everyday life. And that's incredibly powerful. And it helps us understand both ourselves and other people. And so when we founded the company, our goal was to make fun and interesting stories, but that also have an activist underpinning where it's not in your face. It's not Charles Dickens repeating it 7 times in case you didn't get it and hitting you over the head with a hammer. But later, you might suddenly have a realization if it doesn't happen to you during the storytelling. And we've had a lot of people talk to us after participating with New World Magiscola. I just got an email 2 days ago from someone who, you know, took part in New World Magiscola last July and has just now made connections between things that she experienced and people she interacted with and her perspective on life. And that, to me, is the power of story, but really the power of LARP. And we wanted to get this into the schools, but we've sort of started with adults too, because, you know, it's not like you come of age, you know, that's a myth, that coming of age story, that once you're like 23 or whatever, and you know who you are, and that's who you are for the rest of your life. We come of age over and over again in our lives in the sense that we continue to self-actualize. And so it's not like our views are completely set. They can be changed. It's very hard to change them, but a powerful, emotional, embodied, and imaginative experience can be a shoehorn to that change.
super interesting. I want to ask two questions, one about fiction and one about design. So the design question is, you know, you are very explicit that New World Magiscola specifically is a feminist design. And I want to know what you mean by that. Unpack that.
Oh, well, do you want me to get doctoral dissertation level or?
hell yes. We're always doctoral dissertation level here on Backstory.
Okay. Well, I'll drop a few rhetoric keywords then. Feminist design is a design that leads toward empathy and understanding and less towards competition. There are two types of rhetoric. One type is called agonistic rhetoric, and agonistic rhetoric is rhetoric that's used, words that are used to convince somebody that you're right and they're wrong. And that's sort of the typical Western rhetoric, and it's the rhetoric of war, right? And then feminist rhetoric is not with the goal of competition, of declaring that my experience or my opinion is correct and yours is incorrect, and I get to vanquish you and be the winner at the end. Feminist rhetoric is built on empathy, understanding, compassion. And the goal of feminist rhetoric is to listen and to understand. And one of the things that I noted about a lot of games and a lot of traditional American LARPs, not every American LARP, but a lot of American and Canadian LARPs that are boffer style and based on point values and hierarchies, are filled with the idea that you go there to win. And that's using agonistic rhetoric, right? And I can do things to your character, and I get to be powerful. And there's nothing wrong with getting experience that helps you to feel powerful, but they can lead to sort of, I'm in it for myself, or this kind of way of behaving. And if you've ever played PvP online games, you know that the communities can sometimes be very toxic. And so we designed it specifically with feminist rhetoric and feminist rules, because the goal of the LARPs is to understand and to tell stories, but not to win.
Right. You know, in your keynote at Living Games, you have this interesting point, which is a sub-point to the radical notion that players are people, which is that a lot of game communities are not built on trust because the games are not built on trust. And that's really interesting to me, because we all want to say that, you know, play what you want to play, and games are games, and act as though community design and community maintenance and community building is a completely different thing than game design. But from everything that I've seen from what you've written about Magiscola, you have really the opposite feeling.
Well, I suppose that's true. It has to do with alignment. If we say we want a trusting community, then we need to have principles in place, both as players and as particularly as players, that allows us to trust each other. If our games are set on betrayal and they encourage people to keep secrets and to backstab and to gotcha and to I got to kill your character and haha, now you're petrified, and people are not going to be trustworthy or trusting of others. Because they're always going to have their guard up and think that everyone's out to get them. And a lot of games are designed that way. What we wanted to do was encourage people to take risks in the games and to become vulnerable. And we designed this through classroom principles, because I taught remedial students for many, many years, and they have walls up all over the place, and they don't trust education, right? Because education has told them that they're stupid, they stick their necks out, and as soon as they stick their neck out, they get smacked. And so you have to build this community of trust in a classroom so that people will feel that they can speak up and be vulnerable, and especially write. Because if you're going to write, it's a very vulnerable position, because you're giving your own thoughts. And so I translated that from the classroom to a LARP community where, gosh, we're asking people to be open and honest and to trust each other and to collaborate and to feel like they're going to be able to tell stories together. And in order to trust each other, the game has to first incentivize collaboration and trust, and the people need to know each other and feel strong enough with each other that they can get to that vulnerable place. And you have to align that with the community principles, with the mechanics in the game, and with the world in the game. And it doesn't happen right away. You know, when people start playing New World Magic Scola, the first 12 hours of the game, easy, people are really adjusting and they're still feeling a lack of trust. But there's something that happens somewhere along Friday night, Saturday morning, 24, 36 hours into the game, where they can start to open up because they begin to believe that it's okay to be vulnerable. And I realized I didn't fully answer the feminist question because I got stuck talking about rhetoric. So I wanted to maybe add a little bit more of the feminist principles. And it has to do with alignment that we were just talking about, that the game in its world and in its staff and in its players and in its mechanics, to be feminist means that it questions assumptions about norms and defaults and erasure, that it questions or subverts traditional power structures and hierarchies, that there are positions of power held by non-masculine and diverse identities, that we work to avoid a false binary. Oh, if you are this, then you are not this. We promote intersectional identities. We acknowledge that there is privilege, that you know, some people have privilege in games because they're tall, and some people have privilege in games because they're loud, and some people have privilege in games because they are considered an experienced gamer, and some people have privilege in games because they're male or because they're considered conventionally pretty. And we acknowledge all those things and sort of question them in ways that can try to break those down a little so that we don't just replicate all the problems from our outside society in our games.
If you don't make conscious decisions about what is important, then you're just going to import all of the existing privileges, and those will just be replicated. Well, I'm interested in what are some examples of the ways in which you foster trust and question existing modes of privilege in the game?
So I can give you some examples on the world building level in New World Magic Scola, and in that we have five house founders. Two are women of color, one is a non-binary identity, and one is a male identity. And so we worked hard to try to achieve balance there, and so that you could see in the game positions of the highest rank, right? The revered house founders were not all men, or not all Europeans, or not all a specific gender identity. And so we also wrote all of our characters to be gender neutral. And so any character can be played by any gender. And so it's up to the player to decide what gender the character will be. And that can be the same gender that the person identifies with in their out of game world, or they can explore a different gender identity. And that's very difficult to do sometimes because misgendering is a real and terrible thing that happens. And so we had to try to align that with, if we're going to encourage people to be able to play any gender identity they wish, then how do we make it so that they feel safe to do so? And so we did that on several levels. We put the non-binary character and other characters of varying sexuality in the lore, because it's not enough to just say, hey, you can play any gender you want. Because if they don't see examples of it in the lore, then they'll be like, well, I can play any gender I want, but this world doesn't seem to have any examples of it. So you have to align it in the fiction. And then you have to make it normalized in the culture. And you have to make it normalized in the culture, both in the fiction and out of the fiction. So in the fiction, we made it that they is the default pronoun in the Majimundi. And it's just normal. And if someone tells you that they are he or she or another pronoun, then you use that. But otherwise, if you're not sure, you just use they. And that's a normal everyday practice. And that was liberating and helpful because that's as neutral as you can get, and also as powerful as you can get for breaking down the non-binary. We also put the name on the name tags. We had a player side and a character side, and on both of them we had the pronouns listed of the choice of the player and the choice of the player for the character. And they were in large enough font size that as you approach somebody, you could usually get a quick glance and try to see the pronouns that are in use there and do your best to use those pronouns. And we also put in the code of conduct that the code is that we accept what someone is playing at face value. If we can accept that they are a wizard, that they can do magic, then we can accept that they are a Z or a they, or, you know, so just accept this at face value and don't make a big deal about it. And then we reiterate this. So it's out of game protocol and in game protocol. And then we added a mechanic for a pronoun check. And so that had two parts to it. The first one is, let's assume everyone has heard all of the other things, and let's assume they're doing their very best to use the correct pronouns for everyone. Make that assumption about your co-players, that they're doing their very best. But also understand that people are going to screw up. Because A, conditioning is hard. B, when you're role-playing, you already have a pretty heavy cognitive load. You're trying to remember the lore of the world that you're playing in. You're trying to remember how your character is different from yourself. You're improvising. And when we're under a heavy cognitive load, some of our mindfulness is hard to keep with. So we can make mistakes a little more easily. So if we do the assumption that everybody's trying really hard, but they still might screw up, when they screw up, we don't want to make this huge deal about it. Because some people can feel just absolutely mortified that they have misgendered someone. And it really upsets them and can really, you know, turn into a big conversation. And in talking with trans and non-binary folks, they were like, don't make a big deal about it because I don't want it to turn into, you know.
Yeah. It can sometimes be like more annoying and like make it much worse than just the initial slip up is the huge conversation afterwards where they're like, oh my goodness, I'm so sorry.
Yes. Yeah, and their feelings, the feelings of the person who misgendered are real, but turning it into the focus is even more difficult. And so we introduced the mechanic of the pronoun check where you just say the word, you just say pronoun and then say the correct one. Or you can make the symbol of the letter P from the British Sign Language system, which essentially looks like a P. It takes two hands. Sometimes that's hard to do if you're carrying a wand. But just say pronoun, they. And then the other person just acknowledges, and then you continue. And by having it aligned with, it was represented in the lore, it was normalized in the fiction, it was considered part of the code of conduct, and we had a simple mechanic for correcting it, we had a lot of excellent feedback from people who felt that it was very safe, and we had a lot of people tell us they felt really authentic and recognized in this fictional world much more than they felt so outside of that, because it was the norm, and they also trusted that no one in this group or community was actually maliciously misgendering, because unfortunately that is a real thing, and so they could trust that if a slip up happened, that it was, you know, going to be handled with care. So that's one example of the alignment that we're talking about, and the sort of notion of trying to have intersectional identities. And one of the email that I just got a few days ago was from a player who, when they first signed up for the game and they read some of the stuff in the player conduct, they thought, well, gosh, that's an awful lot of political correctness. and they, you know, had some qualms about it and actually thought, well, I'll just overlook that and go play Magic and have fun. And they ended up, for the first time in their lives, interacting with a person with a non-binary gender identity and had a really life-changing experience where they reflected on their own thoughts about political correctness and about identities and about what is right, quote right, and quote wrong, and what is, quote, normal and not normal, really realized the humanity as well as their own bubble that they had sort of kept themselves in and opened up to recognizing and that the world is larger than they had previously allowed themselves to experience. And so they were writing to us to tell us how much they learned about themselves and their own sort of blinders or prejudices, but also how they had learned, you know, about others and really felt differently about how certain laws and certain norms and certain things can actually oppress other people.
Wow.
And so that was like, oh my gosh, first of all, awesome that you had that. Secondly, wow, you took the time to like reflect on that and write it down and send it to me, which is really, really cool, you know? And so if that can happen, you know, that's a major thing. But even if something even smaller than that can happen through LARP, then that's a good thing to be doing.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. There's something that I want to explore about specifically the fiction of Magiscola and the way that we are given characters. I can say we, because I was in Run 4.
That's
and
right.
I had lots
that's
of fun. Right. Professor I feel like Ziga. I should say that too, like full disclosure. I had a lovely time. But we're given these characters who have opinions about those things, and mm-hmm. maybe they sort of align with ours and maybe they sort of don't. Mm-hmm. And a bunch of real world issues are kind of swept under the rug in the lore. And I don't mean that in a bad way. Like sexual orientation and gender identity are just not axes of oppression in this world. And it's just decided that like, yeah, that's just not something we're going to play with.
That's right.
And, but the idea of doing that isn't to create a utopia.
No.
Yeah. So tell me about some of the ethical issues that people got to not just debate, but like engage with people on, like genuinely, truly engage with. Mm. And how were you able to make ones that were, or to develop that fictional history that feels so relevant and so worth talking about while being so completely and utterly fictional and magical?
Maybe it's all those English degrees. but who says English degrees aren't useful? So yeah, well, what you're talking about was something that we angsted about so much because we didn't want people to play oppression on real world identities. We didn't want people to assume that a player who has a darker or lighter skin represents a specific type. There are not any races or categories in this world. We didn't want someone to be oppressed on, as you said, gender identity or sexual orientation. These are real world things that the people deal with every day. And so let's leave those behind into this world, but we're going to replicate them in a way through the fictional kinds of oppression. The Magimundi is attempting to be a progressive society, but let's face it, it's pretty autocratic in a lot of ways.
Fascist oligarchy.
It's a fascist oligarchy. It really is. And we set that up on purpose. And we've had this question before going, why don't you create a utopia? And it's like, well, it's not realistic in the way, and it doesn't help teach people in the way, because what's going to happen is people are going to bring in oppression into a fictional world. Even if you don't write it in there, the players are going to bring it in there, because this isn't where you read a story. It's where a story is created. And people, first of all, want conflict. And second of all, if there's a vacuum, they're going to fill it with something that they'd already know, which means if you don't say racism and discrimination on sexual orientation is not allowed, somebody's going to try to play that. And so you have to be explicit about that. But if we set up these allegorical and metaphorical ways of looking at the way the world works, you can make that connection, sometimes at the game, sometimes after the game, sometimes months after the game, to say, wait, X is like Y, right? The oppression of the vampires and the discussion of whether they belong in this country, in this community, in this magical community, is similar to immigrants, or the difference between lichens and lugaroos and whether they are allowed to be out about their quote condition is analogous perhaps to sexual orientation. And so they're in there in these other ways. So an example is the way that the Magimundi deals with children who are born of mundane parents who manifest magic. And we put it in the world as this terribly autocratic way of members of the Cinnabar Society show up and will take the child from the mundane family and sometimes wipe the memories of the mundane family or tell the mundane family that the child has died or some awful thing, right? to do. And that's not every time, but that was the practice. Mm-hmm. And it's moving a little bit away from it, but it's still the official law. And this is, of course, feels awful, right? Why would you rip some child away from their loving family, assuming hopefully loving family, and bring them away and give them to a foster magical family and tell them they could have no contact with their original birth family? And this, of course, is analogous to a couple of things. It's analogous to adoption. It's analogous to slavery and what was done with slave families and taking the children away. And it's terribly analogous to what was done with our First Nations or Native American communities, where they took children and put them in schools to try to assimilate them. And we wrote it that way on purpose, and it's supposed to be horrifying. And it's supposed to help you to think about those things. Jason Morningstar was an ethics professor, and he was looking at the way the vampires are dealt with in the Majimundi and whether we should accept them and make them a part, of the community as they are in a portion of the world in the Thunderbird province. And the students, without thinking through it all the way, actually basically created the argument that the vampires should be corralled and kept in a specific place so that Whoa. They could be safe. Yeah, I know.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, and oh dear, yeah. And by the time, and they were completely earnest about this for a while, right? Because it seemed like a great solution of the idea that they'll be safe, right? And we can protect them. And then suddenly the light bulb started to go off about internment camps and reservations and other things. And so the thing is, people are too smart to want to play or listen to if you make it on the nose. And they begin to feel bad, and they begin to feel defensive. And so, but if they're dealing with it in a fictional reality, and then they make the connection, then it's an epiphany. The walls are down, rather than if we're talking about Japanese internment camps and how awful they were treated, which is a very real reality, or Native Americans who were boxed into a reservation. Some people are not going to open up to that because they're going to feel such terrible guilt.
Yeah, it challenges them in a way that, they don't want to have their comfort challenged.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes, yeah.
I think it's actually crucially, crucially important that none of these issues, whether we're talking about chupacabras or vampires or lugaru, none of them are one-to-one analogies of real-world things. It's not like, oh, okay, werewolves are gay people. Like, because when you do that, then first of all, you can start having an argument about how good an analogy is that for this other thing. Like, no, there are certain crucial differences between werewolves and gay people. Like, werewolves, like, gay people don't change into monsters at the full moon or whatever.
Right.
But also, it allows you to have a more nuanced discussion about sometimes things that surround it. So, like, when I got to play in the Parlor LARP version of Magiscola, which I hope people are getting excited about, it's very much about Lugaru and mm-hmm. And lichens. And so the conversations that we were having were just about criminalization mm-hmm. and ability and perceived disability and difference,
yes.
and how people deal with how potential social solutions to difficult and dangerous things, without it just being, okay, let's just find and replace word one with word two and all have our same opinions.
That's right.
So what is the advantage of doing that, but also in a place where people are speaking to each other face to face? Do you think it's been genuinely transformative for people?
Yes. If the metaphors are so blatant and one to one, people are going to see through them, and then they're going to start talking ironically, almost. I wink, wink. I know what this really is, and so we worked very hard, both with putting those kinds of conflict into the world, and also with the Magiscola houses. People were at first confused with the Magiscola houses because they were like, well, which one's Slytherin and which one's the brave one? And, And it's like, well, all the houses have a light side and a dark side. And so it's kind of the way any trait can have a positive and a negative. So anything taken to, and it took people a while to figure out that we weren't making Dubois equal Hufflepuff, right? Because they, but people, that's a normal thing for a lot of people because they come with the learning process, right? The learning process always is you start with what they already know, right? And so they already knew Harry Potter. So they were trying to hook onto, the Harry Potter universe. And then they start making these comparisons. But if you've got a compelling story and a compelling fiction, they're going to be able to detach a little from that, this is like this, because it's what I already know. And they can get into that space called the threshold in pedagogical theory, right? And the threshold is where they're teetering on that edge. Like imagine a door frame, right? And behind them is what they already know, and ahead is the unknowable, right? That they don't know. And they're sort of standing there in that space of, do I step forward, right? I can't, and if you give them that nudge to step into that unknown and experience, and that's what we were trying to do.
I just think it's interesting that so many of the people who I've spoken to who went to Magiscola described it as a transformative experience or an empowering experience. What kind of empowerment are you designing for, and how do you design for something like that?
It comes from the years of being an English teacher and seeing how empowering voice is, right? When people get to say what they think, when they get to write and speak about their own personal experiences, when they get to draw from the well of their experience and the way that they perceive the world and make some sense and order of it, which is what communication is, right? We're trying to make sense and order of our existence. And then when somebody says, I hear you and I get it, then that is absolutely empowering. And so that can be done through poetry. It can be done, but a lot of times what happens through poetry or fiction or the other things is you don't get to see the audience, right? Sometimes you do at a poetry reading, but a lot of times somebody's reading your poem that you've never met, and they're reading your poem and they're like, yes, that's been put into words the way I feel and I understand, and now I get things better than I did before. And they might write as a fan to an author or producer, but they're not there at that moment. The cool thing about LARP is you're standing there with other people as these things begin to happen. And I know that in a LARP, you're not necessarily trying to have yourself be understood, but your character wants to be understood, and your character wants to matter, and your character wants to make decisions that impact the world, and your character wants to be heard. But the thing about LARP is, it's you. You're in your body. It's your voice. You might have an accent. You might have a costume. You have an alibi to try to be not you. And yet, at the bodily level, and even at the emotional level, it is you. And so when your character goes through this, I came up with a solution. Other people thought it was a good solution. We enacted this solution and we did it. We fixed the problem. Your character feels great, but so do you. Which is why, to me, it makes no sense for people to say, it wasn't me, it was my character. Because in a role-playing situation, it still always is you. You can't, you're there. Your body, if you're experiencing a fear in a LARP situation, at a certain lizard brain level, your body is producing those hormones and is, having those reactions, that even if they're controlled reactions, some of that is still going on, which is why the experience lives with you long after the LARP. Because it's not just in your mind, it's in your cells, it's in your brain, it's in your body. There's other ways of experiencing. You were there feeling the tension in the air. You were there. And so it's such a powerful medium. Because it's so immersive, if it can be done so that you feel immersed.
It seems to me like there's actually a very strong connection for you between the empowerment of LARP and the empathy piece. Those two, there's a really strong connection there.
There is. There is. Gosh, that's the real underpinning of it, and how I hope we can make a change on society. Because before we can work together as a community, we have to see outside of ourselves. It has to be about us, but also about more than us. And when our walls are up and our defenses are up, and we're only worrying about ourselves and those people that we've pulled into our tight circle, and we're not able to see from another's point of view, how can we work together to solve greater problems that are affecting all of us? And there's all kinds of research and studies about people who had certain opinions about poor people, for example, and they actually took these people who had ne to poor neighborhoods or poor villages, and just seeing and experiencing and going through and began a process of understanding, where before they were so detached from it. But there was the embodied experience of walking through the poor village, or even talking to some of the people who live in poverty, that changed these people's opinions. And I think we could do that through games and through LARP in particular, because let's face it, not everyone can fly to a poverty-stricken village in Haiti, right? But we can deal with, in a game, an embodied experience that helps us to understand the plight of being poor. And when we can begin to empathize with someone whose experience is different than our own, then we can begin the process of working together. And that's what I hope we can do through storytelling, and particularly through role play.
I think there's just such tremendous value in stretching the empathy muscle, in just having practice empathizing with another person who is directly in front of you. Yeah, just the opportunity to look at another person in the eyes and actually engage with them is, I don't know, for some reason not as frequent as one would hope.
No, it's I think it's not, because a lot of our social interactions with others are very surface level. And a lot of times they are with those walls up, right? We're trying to hone our reputation. We're worried that the person is trying to sell us something, or we're worried that that this person has an agenda. When you can get into a microcosm of a fictional world, you can have a little bit more freedom if the norms of that fictional world and community allow you to open up in your interactions. And when we role play a character, that's already one level of empathy, because we're already trying to think like the character and not like ourselves. But when we're the big level of empathy is when we start to empathize with another character or another person. And so, we are not a lichen, but we have a best friend in our house who's a lichen, and they're really worried that they're going to be found out. And we begin to empathize with that idea of, I have a secret and it could cause me to get kicked out of school. And, what will you do? Well, I'm going to help my friend, right? Well, your friend isn't really supposed to be here in the school according to the law, right? Well, but is that law fair? I'm going to side with my friend, right? And so that sort of thing is how it gets started.
And we even get to see these sort of tiny microcosmic effects of what we think should be solutions. So even if someone's playing a character, or even they themselves immediately think, like, okay, lichens are demonstrably dangerous, so we shouldn't have them at school. And you can have that opinion. And then over the course of the LARP, you find out that, but when we have a law that says they shouldn't be at school, no one divulges that they are lichens. And even when they have a non-lycanthropy related problem, they don't seek help for it because they're worried about being found out about being a lichen. So, it seems like there are actually all of these effects that I get to see because I'm engaging with people that I wouldn't get to see if I just decided that that was the solution from my perspective previously.
Yes, perfect. And that's why you mentioned earlier about us writing the characters. And it's why the characters are not rolled in the sense of some of the larger LARPs, where you just get a character sheet and you have complete control over it. It's because we're working on trying to have balance in the LARP, not just among the houses and the majors, but also among some of these perspectives. So some characters are given bigots. Some characters are bigots. And those can be very difficult to play because that person needs to play an attitude that is in conflict with some others or becomes a bad guy in this sense. It's a huge responsibility, but we wouldn't get to wrestle with these ideas if we didn't have diversity of opinions. And diversity of opinions is the way society is. And if we give someone a character that they're not comfortable with, we're going to have give them another character or work with them to write one that they are. But we don't want all the characters to be progressive, or we don't want all the characters to be bigots. We don't want to, right? And so you should find a diversity of opinions throughout a Magiscola LARP, which will lead to these kinds of discussions. And, you know, you're going to become a citizen of the Magimundi, which means you're the next generation. And so these things are important, the way you live and your friends and the people around you. So, I mean, we built in education is ridiculously expensive and people have to have scholarships. And we built in medicine that's necessary for people to live as being patented. And so there's a lot of real world parallels that are in there, but they, as you said, hopefully they don't jump right out at you to make you feel, oh, look, this is about why are EpiPens so expensive?
Right. And that was actually going to be one of my questions. Are there villains in Magiscola?
Well, there are definitely villains in the lore. Jack Slager is a villain. The Gorecasters are villains. They do medical, you know, magical experiments on humans. You know, we can look at Akeldama, who raised a revenant army and was pursuing the school. In terms of characters, professors and students, I would say that there are, since we are playing, the students are playing that they're in college, there's the idea that they can become the wizard that they want to be, right? And so we may have students or faculty who are villainous, right? Who have attitudes or who have been hurt in the past and are angry, who are behaving in ways that that are oppressive, and they are villainous. But to say that they're a villain leaves no possibility, in my mind, for redemption. And I would hope that some of our villainous characters can be on a redemption arc, if possible. Some villains are villains, and they never can be redeemed because they don't reflect and they don't change and they continue to oppress and to go. And so that's why there's Avernus Prison, right? But in the LARP is more about if you have oppressive ideas, if you behave badly, if you do, is there a way for you to redeem that? Maybe it's through friendship. Maybe it's through realization. Maybe it's through healing of past wounds. Maybe it's through love. Maybe it's through knowledge. But if we can explore that idea of where does some of the bullying or oppressive behavior come from, and sometimes it comes from upbringing, right? Sometimes it comes from too strict adherence to the laws, right? Sometimes it comes from a feeling of righteousness and thinking they're doing the right thing. Let's explore where that comes from, because that to me is a valuable thing to think about for society, right? School shootings, mass shootings, they're a terrible, terrible thing. How did that person get to the place where that was their solution? And that person is definitely a villain. Like they can't just go out and cause mass mayhem and kill innocent people. Right. But as a society, let's think about what's going on here, too. Right. That doesn't excuse what they did. But there's probably a reason why we have so many of them in America versus other countries. And there's probably a reason that's not as simple as, well, we have more guns, although that may be a contributing factor. So if we can think about that in a fictional world and start to think more complexly, so much of what we get now in the media is sound bites and black and white, and people's stuff is so filtered, they only get the kind of news that they already agree with. And people are complex. Societies are complex. The world is complex. And we need to think about things in a complex and nuanced way.
You've written, I'll probably link to this article in the show notes, your article on NordicLARP.org about the safety and calibration techniques in Magiscola. I think what's interesting is that those aren't just safety techniques in the sense that, okay, we need to make sure people don't get physically hurt or emotionally hurt so we can continue to play the game interrupted. It seems to me like you're trying to cultivate a culture in which it is safe to go that deep and safe to have those conversations and to get really, really real about a lot of stuff like that. If any of our, we could probably do an entire episode just on the safety techniques in your game, but just in case any of our listeners don't know, what were some of the ways that you cultivated that culture?
Oh, wow. Well, we made it okay for people to exit a scene without anyone saying that, you know, that it was wrong to exit, because players have real world needs. It might be a bodily need, it might be an emotional need, but they could use the look down, which is they essentially put their hand on their forehead and look down, and they could exit, and nobody's going to say, "Where are you going?" And so that meant people could opt in and opt out of scenes that they wanted, found interesting, or wanted to take part in. We also cultivated a sense that we should check in with our fellow players to make sure they're doing okay. And sometimes in heavy and intense role-play situations, we might not be sure whether the character is sad or the player is actually sad and upset. And if we're not sure, we should check in. Because someone could be in really feeling down or lonely or distressed or just not able to connect to the game. And we as fellow players can help them. And so just flashing the okay symbol, right? The little circle with the three fingers up at somebody, and they get to respond. Thumbs up, right? I'm doing great. This is just role play. I'm in the corner and I'm crying, and this is what I want to be doing. You know,
yeah,
it's a great scene. I'm really feeling this emotion, you know, or I'm role playing the seizure that I'm having. I am not actually having a seizure. And then they can respond thumbs down, which is, hey, not good at all. Maybe I need to take a break. Maybe I'm too hot. Maybe I'm too overwhelmed. Maybe I'm too. But we found that a lot of people aren't going to thumbs down because we're culturally conditioned to be tough. And also, especially in a lot of role play cultures, there actually is a lot of norms like, what's the matter? Can't you take it? It's just a game. Why are you upset? And women in particular are conditioned to be like, I'm fine. I'm fine. Right. You know, and so we introduced the flat hand, the kind of so-so, because we found that people are more willing to say than to actually say thumbs down, because thumbs down is sort of an admission. But we said that the norm is we take a flat hand as, you know, I don't really want to admit it, but I really need some help. And so you can pause the game for that moment and have the person get some water or take a break, or maybe they need to see the counselor, or maybe they need to take a walk. And that's okay. It doesn't mean that you broke the game. It doesn't mean that you ruined somebody's role play. It doesn't mean any of those things. And it was so heartening to see people using that because they were showing care and compassion for their fellow players. And I've heard from players that they've actually started using this sort of thing in their workplace. They'll pop by somebody's, you know, office or cubicle and flash the okay symbol, you know, and maybe somebody just needs 5 minutes to talk. So I'm pleased that one seems to have worked pretty well. We also used Largo, which is a musical term that means go slow. And that was a way that people could say, whoa, the scene's getting a little too intense for me too fast. Can we just, you know, dial it back a little? And that was really empowering for people because they might not want to quit, but they were starting to feel overloaded. Or maybe somebody was a little too close or a little too loud or whatever. And by normalizing the idea that people can opt in with consent to the kinds of things that they want to participate in, that was also very empowering, what you were talking about earlier. It was like, hey, I don't have to just sit here and take this. I can say, Largo, and we're going to make this more comfortable for everyone.
So I often describe New World Magiscola as a sort of North American adaptation of the Polish LARP College of Wizardry, which is not totally fair, actually, the more that I read about both of them. What aspects of that game were you importing, and which were you building on and changing and or leaving behind?
Oh, good question. So we did adopt the basic magic system from College of Wizardry and the basic 4-day, 3-night structure that culminated with a ball. And so Ben and I had been to College of Wizardry in Poland, and that dramatic structure works really well. And the magic that's based on the defender, the recipient, deciding the effect of the spell was incredible and empowering. And that was sort of the base that we brought over to the United States. And we said, okay, we want to create a wizard school in the U.S., but we're going to rewrite it with a complete North American culture. And we're going to have our houses and our history have to deal with and interweave with North American history, which is very different from European history. You know, we're dealing with imperialism and colonization, and we're dealing with a hugely diverse nation. And of course, we made the Majamundi have a lot of crossovers with overt capitalism and, you know, and as you said before, fascism and oligarchy. But we said, that consent-based magic was so powerful because, first of all, there was no calling of numbers and having to do math in your head when somebody is doing a spell on you. Certain games have packets, spell packets that you throw at someone, and you know, and you're calling out five, 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 and you have to subtract in your head. My character has 30 hit points, and so how many? That was five. Five packets, that's 25, so I have 5 hit points left, so I am gravely injured. And for us, there's nothing wrong with those systems, and some people really enjoy them, but for us, that focused on the math and not on the role play. And so the additional thing that can happen there is someone comes up to you and says, I have 25 experience points, how many do you have? And you're like, well, I'm a new player, I only have 10, and so the other guy says, well, I have 25, ha, 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 you have to do what I say. And they would win every conflict. And so what a consent-based magic system does is it allows the defender to decide what happens. So if I cast a spell on you, Alex, you can decide, does the spell hit me? Do I take the effect, the intended effect of the spell? And I might want to because it might be fun and interesting. And if I'm feeling like I trust you and I want to tell a great story, I might actually take that effect because it'll be interesting to see where it goes. But I also might not feel like doing it. Maybe you're casting a barf spell on me and I don't want to role play barfing, right? And so I don't have to. I can deflect that spell. I can declare that I'm wearing an amulet that protects me from the spell. I can say that you mispronounced the spell. I can cause the spell to glance off of me. So maybe I cough for a moment and then say, huh, nice try, you know, or I can actually declare that the spell had an unintended effect. So you were trying to cast a barf spell on me, and I decide it made me dance. And that's surprising and interesting. And so now suddenly you, the caster of the spell, the barf spell, suddenly goes, whoops. or have to deal with a roleplay situation that can be fun that comes out of that. And it's not then just about a power struggle. I cast a barf spell on you, and since I had 25 and you had 15, you have to take it. It's about magic can be capricious, and magic can be is also very personal. And also, let's face it, we're magic school students, so we might not be perfect all the time. And we're going to have unintended consequences. You know, whoops, I put the cat hair into the polyjuice potion, right? You know, and those are actually fun to role play, and it gets you to a level of vulnerability and collaboration with your fellow students. And so nobody can make your player do anything without your consent. And that's a hugely different thing than, say, most vampire LARPs, right? Where you go to a vampire LARP and this player is the prince and they can tell you what to do, or they can give a mind power on you and you know, or they can kill your character right then. And nobody can kill your character. You can decide to die, but nobody can petrify your character and leave you tied up in a room for 3 hours, right? I mean, all those things are done with your consent. If you really want to be petrified for 3 hours, you can choose to do so, but nobody's going to make you do that. And that's a sense of empowerment. And what that leads to is consent negotiations, which is something I think we could use a lot more of in the real world.
Oh my gosh, yes. I had that experience of having someone ask me to the dance. And then at some point over the weekend, we talked about, oh, hey, when we go to the dance together, what do you think would be interesting for that date? And how do you kind of want it to go? What are your like physical boundaries, or and also like just boundaries around romantic play in general?
Exactly.
And, you know, we just talked about that. And then after that conversation, I thought, man, I want to have that conversation before every date. Like, that's just that's just good stuff.
It's so true, because we're not very practiced at that. And women can often be socialized to play it coy and not say no directly. And those things can actually be, you know, obviously really problematic. They can, you know, they can contribute to rape culture. And so one of the things we had to think about was those kinds of negotiations. You have to mean what you say too, right? So if you say, yes, I'm comfortable with that, the other person needs to be able to take you at face value. And if you're not comfortable with that, you should say it. But we're not in a culture, unlike the culture outside, where somebody's going to say, why? What's the matter? You don't want to do that? You're not, you know, that is outside the norm here. And hopefully those kinds of consent negotiations and empowerment can live beyond the 4 days of Magiscola and help you, you know, you got a sense, you got a chance to practice saying no, and I'm not comfortable with that, and those sorts of things. And maybe you'll be better at saying that the next time it happens, even outside of Magiscola. Let's hope.
Yeah, you'll have a demonstration of what it looks like when people are able to do that, because it's very good. You will discover. You'll discover it's very good. Do people come to you asking how they can organize something like Magiscola? And if so, what do you tell them?
We have had people come to us looking to sort of replicate, either replicate a wizard school, but in more cases, we've had people come to us, ask us how to replicate some of the safety and calibration and community building techniques. And we are very willing to mentor folks on that because we believe it's really important. And sometimes it's really hard to do if you have a very established community that's used to being a certain way. We had the, you know, luxury of building this from the ground up, and people who came to the game knew that these were going to be the norms, and we didn't have to try to turn a culture around. Turning a culture around is much harder. It's not impossible, but it is much harder. And so I'm pleased that Dystopia Rising, for example, which is, you know, the largest LARP in the United States that some 7,000 people take part in, has instituted a safe space, a sanctuary, a quiet space at their games, just, and also instituted the OK check-in that we talked about earlier. And seeing that replicated, that's we've been working with White Wolf. Myself and Johanna Kojolin from Finland have been working with White Wolf, and an article about the OK check-in is going to be in a Mind's Eye Society manual that's coming out soon. And
that's great.
That's also, you know, a huge, huge LARP that a lot of people take part in. And if we can get just a little bit of an idea of the story you tell and the characters you play is really important, but let's never forget that there are people that are there who have needs and different experiences. You know, I might be able to handle jumping off the back of a truck into simulated gunfire and explosions. And I might find that really empowering and exciting, right? But there might be someone there who has had an experience in the past that makes them have a real bodily reaction to those loud noises or those close spaces, mm-hmm. or the smoke and those things. And those people's experiences are valid. And if they're having trouble, then we shouldn't deride them or make them feel bad that they're having that experience. And so little changes in culture that can start to happen are awesome. And I'm really pleased to see that people are really interested in role-playing in a collaborative style, the feminist collaborative style, where it's not necessarily about winning, but it's about exploring a topic. And I hope that we see more of it. And I'm very willing to talk to any LARP creators, especially diverse LARP creators, to other women, to people of queer identities, to people of color, to say, let's make these games and let's explore these opportunities and let's try to build a better world.
Yes. Yay. Well, the other thing, well, two things, I guess. I mean, one thing, when will we be able to see the home game version of Magiscola available for people?
Let's see, which way do you mean? We're working on a few things here. We are working on a Magiscola board game or card game, which is pretty fun. You're a character, you take some courses and you try to finish first. It's a bit more competitive than I would say the LARP experiences. So it gives you a sense of playing a magical school student, but you are trying to be the person who has the most house points at the end. But that's one way to experience wizard school at home and to get involved with the lore, because the monsters and some of the other things do appear there. We are working on two things that'll be for home version as well. A Wolf by Any Other Name, which is the parlor LARP that you played recently. We're working on hoping that can be sort of LARP in a box, or let's see, how do we put this so that it's, quote, social party game in a box?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So
the new code word.
The new code word, right? And so you could gather a group of anywhere from 6 to 25 people. And I actually think it works better with a smaller group. And we'll have the rules and the story and the cards and the way for you to play out a conflict that helps us wrestle with that Lycan loop guru divide and, you know, someone who's sick with lycanthropy and the idea of being outed, and it role plays that with the very expensive potion and who controls, who gets access to the medicine. All those things are wrestled with in that game. And there are cards that help us to run that game, but it's very much a role playing, stand up on your feet LARP game. And then we are working on a tabletop RPG that's collaborative storytelling based. So it won't be straight up, you come around the corner and you find this, you know, roll a d20. That is, I would argue, very end of 2017 is probably when it's going to be available, because we're working very carefully with that one to make it collaborative based, because we're trying to replicate that sense of empathy and working together for problem solving, as opposed to just call the healer or, you know, but we also want to tie in, as I said earlier in the podcast, we have to deal with what people already know. So when people see a tabletop RPG, they already have some expectations. So how can we hit those expectations and then build upon them, right? Because we don't want it to be so foreign that somebody's like, you know, this is not like that. But we're working with a few people who are fantastic at collaborative storytelling and using systems to get people to work together on that. So that one will probably develop a little more slowly, but hopefully by the end of this year, maybe by Gen Con, we'll have, but we will have the board game in its final prototype at Gen Con, and we will have A Wolf by Any Other Name at Gen Con. And we're going to run Magiscola Minis at Gen Con as well, where you can take a single course. You can take a course in magical combat and defense, or take a course in ritual magic. And that will lead to, you can take those as standalones, but if you want to, on the Saturday, you can take place in the challenge, which will be sort of a use your knowledge from the other classes and apply it to various magical challenges.
That sounds really fun.
So I hope so. That's what we're thinking. So and you get a taste like, oh, I did Magiscola for an hour. I did Magiscola for 4 hours. I should really go do it for 4 days, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so
that helps to break down some of the were you there or were you not there kind of in-out group thing that I really, really don't want to happen. Like, because when you meet other Magiscola alumni, like, you just want to talk about wizard school, especially if they were in a different run than you, and you want to say, like, who was your Ziegler? Oh my gosh, our Ziegler was like this, and did you guys do any of that ley line stuff? No, our run didn't have the whatever ritual.
Right.
So it's very exciting, it's very fun, but then, like, I don't want it to become clicky.
Clicky.
Do you worry about that? Do you get concerned about that at all?
I really, really do, because let's face it, the 4 day, 3 night is an all inclusive experience where the lodging is included, all of your food is included, it's high immersion, you know, there's a big budget for props. And so it leads to a destination, you know, and expensive, you know, it's a large chunk of money at once for people. And so let's face it, that even as if we price it as low as we possibly can, which we do, to make it as accessible as possible, it's going to be inaccessible to some people. And that really hurts me, which is why we're trying to develop the home versions and the board game versions and some of the other things, so you could be a part of the universe. You know, we did have a good success with the Compendium of Creatures, and we're working on a novel. And I think there are ways that that you can start to engage with the universe and then engage in some of the role play, is my hope. Mm-hmm. We're not going to be able to ever fully replicate 160 people together creating a story over 4 days. That's going to continue to be magical. You can participate, you know, through groups. We're trying to work on some online role play forums and some other ways to try to open this up to people, because it is possible to be part of a community and contribute to the community, even if you can't go physically to the 4-day immersive event.
Right. A lot of people are very eager to go back, and some of them are very eager to play their characters again. Is that exciting to you? Does that concern you?
It's both. It's both exciting and concerning. Because, first of all, people who had a great time and want to come back, that's awesome. I talked a little bit earlier about how sometimes you don't get the sense of how to actually play this game until the third day. And so the sense of coming back is fantastic. It also means that those people are really invested in their character, which means we did a pretty good job writing them and giving them a place in the world. But of course, they really took it upon themselves and made it their own. There's more to the story that they want to tell with that character. And they feel that that character is an avenue for them to do that and to also discover more about themselves. So we definitely want return players, and we definitely want people to feel invested in the world and invested in the character. But we're only going to allow people to play the same character at maximum 3 times, which would be, you could go to Magiscola, you could go to Yule, and you could go to Magiscola second semester. And then it's time to set that character aside and pick up a new character. You can still go to Magiscola, but let's pick up a new character that has a different personality, a different house, a different experience. And you get to experience Magiscola all over again with a new identity and a new perspective and a new way of interacting and understanding. One of the things that can happen with long-term LARP communities is people get so invested in their character that they become worried about anything that would happen to their character, or they become very ownership-oriented of that character, and they declare that certain things can be canon, whereas other things can't be canon. And as you mentioned, the characters repeat in different versions of Magiscola. And so Professor Ziegler of Divination, there are 4 Professor Zieglers, right? And what we don't want to have happen is this sense of there is only one Professor Ziegler, or this was my Professor Ziegler, or because we want people to use the characters and to use the role play to explore and to have fun. And it can be great fun. This happened with College of Wizardry in Poland. At first, people felt that same way. And now they're realizing, I played New World Magiscola as a third-year Artificer House President. And now I'm going to come back and play it as a brand new first year who hasn't been sorted into any house and who's going through. And it was so cool to play it as that naive first year who doesn't know how to do it. I didn't have the responsibilities of the third year or the house president. And I got to really, you know, experience it all for the first time. Or my character, I did this with College of Wizardry. My character, I played in 2 LARPs at College of Wizardry. I brought him back later on as a professor. And that was a completely different experience to be a professor. And there's value in interacting with the world from different characters' perspectives. It's the same sort of sense we were talking about earlier of how do people from different circumstances and different backgrounds and different things experience the same world, right? You experience the world the first time as an unsoiled, privileged, rich kid. Now you're going to experience the world as one of those mundane, boring kids who's on scholarship. How does that feel different? And how do I, and I begin to compare the two, and I begin to say, wow, it was a lot easier for me when I was the unsoiled heritage guy who had plenty of money. And so that's what we encourage people to do. We do want them to be invested in the character, but after a second semester run, they need to let go of that character and let's do another one. And let's try the world again. And you will find a sense of loss for a moment, but then you will find you become invested in that new character in that same way you felt when you got the first character for the first time.
It sounds like it's a very well thought out decision. Was it a difficult decision? Have you had pushback? Are a lot of people asking about this kind of thing?
Yes, it is a difficult decision, especially in America and Canada, where we are used to campaign LARPs. And we're used to playing the same character over and over again. There are parlor LARPs, of course, in America and Canada, but they're really one shots, you know, and they're usually only for, you know, 4 hours, 6 hours max. Sometimes they're a weekend, but those are harder to find. And there's no expectation of repeat on them. And whereas this, you know, they know, you know, that it runs every year and that it's sort of a thing. And so some people really had this notion that I will, you know, start with the character as a first year, and then I'll come back and be a second year, and come back as a third year, and maybe then I'll come back as a professor, and I will just have ownership of this character over many, many, many years. And that can be it can be a good model, but it's not the model here, because we want you to tell a story in a collapsed time frame too. We don't want you to develop that story necessarily over years and years and years. And sometimes characters are played out, honest to God, after one new Ormond Escola. We've had people go, yeah, you know, I played that one over the summer. I'm coming to Yule. Can I have a new character? And we're like, sure, you know. And so I think it will help with the community too. And it will help with, you know, the idea of doppelgangers and, you know, timeline problems and which run is considered canon. All those things are going to become problematic. And so it's not a campaign LARP. It is a LARP where you can play the character more than once, but there's a limit. And we don't really have that model so much. The only way you lose a character in a campaign LARP is if it's killed, right? And of course, we have the some people kill their character on purpose because they get tired of it, but most people lose a character in a campaign LARP because something happens and the character gets killed. And then they're in this terrible sense of loss. And and that can be really traumatizing. And we would rather not have that. And so if you can know, all right, I played this character, New Ormond Escola 1, and I took it to Yule, and now I'm coming to second semester. This is the end of this character's track, right? So I need to tell the story. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And I like the idea of having that kind of impetus too. Like, all right, this is our last go. I better, you know, tie up this thread or make this happen or lay right. this to rest.
And
yeah, that's an opportunity.
It is an opportunity because you really will have, you really will push for a good story. And the character doesn't necessarily die after that. I mean, the character I gave as an example, Novak was I played in College of Wizardry 1 and College of Wizardry 2, and then I played her as a professor in College of Wizardry 9. And in my mind, Novak is not dead, right? It's not like something happened to her. Novak is just, you know, off doing her curse-breaking things for clients of dubious repute, running around, getting magical objects and fighting bad guys or, you know, hiding from them or whatever. And so she doesn't have to have an end, and I can continue to write about her or think about her. You know, maybe I'll use her as inspiration for another character. You know, she might appear as the professor for that magical combat class I talked about at Gen Con, but her story, you know, in terms of College Wizardry is finished, right? But that doesn't mean she's dead. And that can actually help with that drop that you can have after a LARP or after a convention or is that that character kind of is still part of you, and you can continue to imagine things for that character, or you can continue to use the forums or role play places to continue a story online. But if you're going to come back, you're going to play a different character. And it's hard to convince people, but it's so cool to have familiar surroundings and lore and a different perspective. You know, and you start implicitly in your head. Last time I was here, I was in Danube, and I was a raven, and I wanted to change the world. And now I'm a Laveau, and I'm more interested in, you know, being cunning and creative and embracing some forbidden magic. Well, that really changes how I interact with the world. And that's where I think some of that empathy building and perspective can really come, is when you experience the world from more than one perspective.
Yeah, I can't wait to hear from players who have done the same LARP from different characters' perspectives. I think that would be really fascinating, actually.
Sounds like another podcast.
Yes, absolutely. Well, is there anything else that you have on the go or anything that you'd like to promote or anywhere you'd like my my listeners to keep up with you and what you and Ben are up to?
Wow. Well, we've talked a little bit about Magiscola, and you can find us at magiscola.com or magimundi.wiki. It's magimundi.wiki. And that's all about New World Magiscola. I talked about the board game, and I talked about A Wolf by Any Other Name, and I talked about that we'll be at Gen Con. We are developing a whole new property in a whole new universe called Edge World. And
that's
going to debut in November of this year. And that is a Wild West steampunk world where we take an area, a town, and its environs from the Nebraska Territory in 1888, and we separate it. And it develops its own sort of history that takes the track of steam. And so we'll be getting to role play some of our Wild West frontier fantasies, but also in a way that we can get in touch with some alternate visions of the way things might have evolved from that time period. And Edgeworld becomes a perpetual frontier. And so it's an isolated world that comes in random contact with parts of our world. So things do come in and things do come out. And that helps us set up some of those dilemmas and things that we were talking about earlier and give you a chance to dress in Victorian period steampunk and to be in a town that's not only is it a frontier town, but now it's an isolated town, right? And so it's dealing with some very interesting resource management kinds of things and what kind of a community are we trying to build. And so that's at thisisedgeworld.com, and it is so it's kind of like Westworld with a steampunk vision, and it won't have the thing with Westworld where the NPCs are just there for being used and abused.
I was just going to say, if you are constructing a world in which I get to enjoy the aesthetic appeal of Westerns without also having to engage with the genocidal fantasies, yes. That sounds very nice and very good to me.
It's also very difficult as we're defining it. We're working with some Native American tribe designers, and we're working with trying to recruit a really diverse team because it's fraught with things, and we obviously want to do what we talked about earlier, is we want to have representation, but we don't want people doing cultural appropriation, and we don't want people playing out stereotypes, or we certainly don't want people using any form of blackface or redface, and we don't want to erase the fact that the frontiers were genocidal oppression, but we don't want to role play continuing that. And so it's fraught with a lot of design challenges, but we're ready to take those on and to listen to people and to try to get those, get that done the best we can. We really need some other designers of color to particularly work with us. I've reached out and we've got a few signed on, but anyone else who's interested in working with us to create that, we would welcome. And so we're still in the design phases of that, and there's a chance to work with us on the ground floor for that. It looks like it's going to take place in Texas, and probably going to be pretty rustic, but there will be a hotel option for those who don't want to camp in a canvas tent.
That sounds like quite a project, quite an undertaking. I think it's wonderful that you have so much goodwill built up after Magiscola to be able to do something so ambitious.
Oh, thank you. I hope so. I hope I still think that 8 weeks from now or something, right? Like the more I don't want to. But I remember having some of these same feelings when we were designing some of the stuff for Magiscola. And it's, it's hard. We're going to make mistakes. We're not going to be perfect, but we are going to listen. And we are going to make changes if we need to make changes, because people's real world experiences matter. And in no way are we attempting to create a game that replicates out-of-world impression, oppression.
Or perpetuates it.
Now, it examines it or questions it. Yes, but allows you to roleplay your fantasy of an ambush, and I get to kill it. No. That's not us. So.
Yeah. Oh, Well, best of luck with that project. It sounds amazing. Best of luck with the 15 million things that you and Ben have on the go at any given time. And you're like still teaching English and doing academic stuff at the same time?
A little bit, not as much as I was, just part-time, but I am still trying to finish that dissertation so I can call myself a doctor here soon. So that is, I'm finished everything except writing the dissertation, and I am working on it, but I'm not working on it quite as quickly as I wish I was, because I'm writing so many other things and we're trying to survive as a small business startup. We're still at that lean stage where the things are moving in the right direction, but we have to bring the projects to fruition to make this sustainable. So the summer camp, Magic School of Prep, we're opening up for middle and high school students this summer. Yeah. We're excited about that. So 1 week is for 14 to 17 year olds and 1 week is for the 11 to 14 year olds. And so.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Well, so, I should have had like a 4-part Maury special. Like, I didn't even know this was going to be a thing.
Yeah. So 2 weeks after the adult Magic School is this summer. So they're going to be at Swarthmore College. And we're very excited. We have hired Ben Schwartz is going to be our camp director.
Awesome. For that.
And who's done a lot of work with Wayfinder and trackers. And so, and it's a very, as a person who's taught school, you know, I taught 9th grade for 9 years. There's a big part of it for me in bringing this to kids. That's really important because they're at that who am I stage so much in that middle and high school age, and feeling that sense of empowerment and identity building that can happen through role play at that point in their life is really huge to me. So we're going to run a kids thing at Gen Con too, just a one class that kids are going to be able to take part in. So
wow, that sounds amazing.
So yeah, you're right. 15 million things on our list, but but that's sort of the life of a startup right now. Yeah. So
if there's any way to sum it up, how do you stay sane? Like, how do you keep all of these plates spinning and still like operate and function?
Wow. You're assuming I am operating and functioning. I guess I'm role playing that really well.
If that's your answer, just LARP it. That's a legit answer, in my opinion.
Yeah. I'm just LARPing sanity and functionality. we have a fantastic team of people who are helping us. We're working very hard. We're working a lot of hours per week, and but the team of people that's working with us, and Ben and I, you know, really keep each other accountable and take up the slack. But and we sometimes, you know, stay sane and say, you know what, we're going to watch Hell on Wheels for 3 hours tonight and not work, right? Yeah.
Yep.
And so taking that downtime is important. So
yay, beautiful. Keep good folks around you and rest when you need to, and then just pretend when you have to.
There you go.
Love it. Done. Maury, do you want to give your Twitter handle or website or anything like that? I know you linked to a few things earlier.
Sure. On Twitter, we're at NW Magic Scola. Mm-hmm. I am personally at Maury Brown. I am not the business of baseball Maury Brown that's out there. And then the website, we're also on Facebook with Edgeworld LARP for the new one. And then at NW Magic Scola again on Facebook. And www.magiscola.com. We're going to have tickets available for our summer sessions in the next few weeks, certainly by Valentine's Day.
Yay. Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. This is really, really fun.
Thank you so much for having me. I always love talking to you, and I hope it worked out well.
Yeah. Oh, it will. I'm sure it has.
That's right.
Well, thanks to Maury for joining us, and as always, thank you for listening. If you have thoughts on today's show, you can always email me, that's backstorypodcast@gmail.com, or you can follow me on Twitter, @backstorycast. Backstory is part of the One Shot Podcast Network. If you like my show, you should totally go to oneshotpodcast.com and listen to Modifier, Talking Tabletop, Campaign, One Shot, the new actual play Satanic Panic, First Watch, Second Watch, it's all good stuff. Check it out. And if you like it, consider becoming our patron at patreon.com/oneshotpodcast. Music for Backstory is provided by Uchiko. The track is called Thinking of You, and you can hear more at soundcloud.com/Ujiko. That's UJICO. Talk to you later, heroes.